You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 21st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Stephen Wertheim, the director of the Quincy Institute's Grand Strategy Program, a research scholar at the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University, author of Tomorrow, the World, the Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. With the message, NATO, not necessarily your friend. Also on the program today, U.S. is withdrawing anti-missile systems from the Middle East. And just as Republicans land on weaponizing it, inflation worries start to ease. Meanwhile, massive anti-Bolsonaro protests in Brazil, as the COVID death rate tops 500,000 people. Hardliner wins in Iran's fairly dubious presidential election. Senate to vote on voting rights tomorrow, certain to fail. White House looks to end Title 42. That's the COVID-related migrant family expulsion program by the end of July. Meanwhile, Catholic bishops want to limit communion for Biden because he believes in a woman's right to choose. Conservative Democrats want to slow the antitrust roll in the House. The VA to provide gender confirmation surgery. And lastly, this morning, the Supreme Court of the United States opens the door for college athletes to be paid. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. It is the beginning of the week. It's exciting. It's Monday. And forgive me if I was a little bit thrown off because...
You had a realization.
Is today Dress Like Sam Day? What is going on here? Like what?
Well, I mean... Matt and Brendan aren't dressed like Sam.
No, I know. They are not.
Well, I'm supposed to dress for the job I want, which is to just take over.
There you go.
And
there you go. All right.
Well, and make sure you're irrelevant.
I don't. We've been sitting here this whole time next to each other, and I didn't notice until I look into the camera. I realized, like, wait a second. All right, we've got a lot to get to in a very short period of time. So let's get to it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, what we present to you now is a tale of two pities. Both Republican stalwarts looking for support from various constituencies. Let's start with Mike Pence. He is at the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Is that what it is, meeting? What could be more Mike Pence-y than Faith and a Freedom Coalition? But unfortunately, Mike Pence, and don't get me wrong, I'm completely in favor of the crowd's reaction to Mike Pence, but probably not for the same reasons. Here he is, not getting necessarily the type of warm welcome that he anticipated. Things are looking a little bleak for Mike Pence's 2024 run.
It is great to be back with so many patriots dedicated to faith and freedom and the road to the majority. And I want to thank my friend Ralph Reed for those overly generous words. I'm deeply humbled by them. Ralph Reed knows me well enough to know the introduction I prefer is a little bit shorter. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order, and I am honored to stand before you today.
Wow, a lot of people yelling that he's a traitor.
Well, yeah, I mean, He did not change the outcome of the election, so there you have it.
Mike Pence is going to face a little bit of headwinds, it seems like, going forward, but very brave of him.
The fever's going to break, I think.
Yeah, the fever. I think it's just a matter of time. Meanwhile, Ron Johnson, and Johnson's up for re-election in 2024. We talked about the other day, 2022. We talked the other day that there may be some pickup opportunities for the Democrats in the Senate. Ron Johnson could be one of those pickups. I mean, here he is not doing so well with he showed up at a Juneteenth celebration. You'll recall last year, Ron Johnson was the one who basically voted it down by saying, like, I don't understand why we would pay federal employees to take a day off to celebrate the end of slavery. Can't figure that one out, Ron Johnson. And here are people have not forgotten. Yeah. Yeah. A little bit uncomfortable for Ron Johnson there. But hopefully he has even more problems going forward as he starts to get ready for his run for re-election in 2022.
Yeah. The run for re-election that was supposed to not happen. Is that accurate?
Are you suggesting that one should be held to the promise of being
a one limiting
of term limiting himself?
Well, I mean, since he ran on it, perhaps, but I mean, I don't want to fall into the trap of using Republicans' words and purported truths against them because they lie with impunity and it doesn't seem to have any consequences.
To be fair, you can find new information once you become a senator. You might find that, like, oh, wait a second, it makes sense to me now that I should have two terms.
Yeah, it impassions me to remain in office and continue to advocate for the fewest federal holidays possible, because we've got to keep our workers in line.
Yeah, indeed. And the idea of celebrating slavery ending, would we?
Yeah, I don't even see the significance of that. That doesn't shock me.
Ron Johnson, there he is. And hopefully, yes, that will dog him for quite some time. But apparently he decided to give up the ghost on that. I'm not exactly sure what it was that convinced him over the past year. Maybe slavery just seemed a little bit worse this year and a little more reason.
Maybe he went to a museum like Marjorie Taylor Greene.
That's right. That's right.
She figured out the Holocaust was bad and he figured out slavery was bad. It's a year of education.
Good week for Republicans in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Stephen Wertheim. He has written a piece about, and this was obviously in the wake of Joe Biden's trip to Europe, meeting with the G7. He met with, had a summit with Putin as well. And important idea about, you know, the efficacy and the value of NATO in this day and age. We're going to take a quick break. Emma's going to step out for a bit, and you'll be back for the fun half.
Will do.
All right, great. Quick break, and we'll be right back with Stephen Wertheim. Folks, today's show is sponsored, at least in part, by FastGrowingTrees.com. This is a product. This is another one of those products, frankly, that I was using prior to them becoming advertisers, and I'm super happy about it because I'm actually getting fruit. It's bearing fruit, if you will, this relationship. So here's the deal. Folks who have listened to this show for a long time know that I do a little fruit tree planting.
Yeah.
And
the bearing fruit. I get it now.
There you go. I planted a couple of Korean pear trees. They look like massive apples when you get them. I put them in the ground more or less, I would say in spring of last year. And they have at least a dozen fruit on both of them, you know, and we had a good spring this year. It got warm early and then there was no freeze. And this is what fast growing trees are about. They send much hardier and larger trees than your average nursery. And so they start paying off much quicker. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going out and selling the Korean deer. I'm just saying, like, you want them to bear fruit. Mm-hmm. You can skip the big box stores. You head to fastgrowingtrees.com. They are the world's largest online nursery. Incidentally, I don't know what, you go to those box stores, you're not getting a Korean pear tree. You're just not going to find one there. You're going to find some very basic trees that are not necessarily cared for that well. The best way to buy trees, shrubs, and plants for your home and yard, it's fastgrowingtrees.com. You don't have to wait in lines. You don't get your car messed up. You don't have to dig through a lackluster selection. You just go to fastgrowingtrees.com. You choose from thousands of varieties of trees, shrubs, and plants, expertly curated to thrive in your area and delivered to your door in just 1 or 2 days. You can look for shade or privacy or fruit trees like I have, or you just add some color for your yard. I got 2 bloomerangs. And these are lilacs that bloom twice.
Aww.
So they already did once. I got the purple, and they're going to come back around. Again, tree I planted last year. Planting season is here. You can join over 1 million satisfied gardeners at fastgrowingtrees.com. Plus, the 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee means your plants will arrive happy, healthy, and ready for planting. Now through July 31st, you go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. You get 15% off. That's 15% off. fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. You will be happy you did. All right. I'm going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Stephen Wertheim, director of the Quincy Institute's Grand Strategy Program. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the Zoom, I guess. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Stephen Wertheim. He is the director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, also visiting faculty fellow at the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School, a historian and author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. Stephen, thank you for your time. You sound very busy, but appreciate your being.
It only sounds that way.
So we're talking in the wake of Joe Biden's trip to Europe for both to meet with NATO and to have a summit with Vladimir Putin. And this is also in the wake of a piece that you wrote for The New York Times. Sorry, liberals, but you really shouldn't love NATO. Let's start there. Let's just start, I mean, if you will, with a sort of a brief overview of what the purpose of NATO was, ostensibly, because on some level, NATO now, and I think this is part of your argument, feels like a solution to a problem that doesn't exist, or that is searching for a problem in some respects.
It has been openly searching for that problem for about 3 decades. So originally, NATO had a very clear purpose. It was created early in the Cold War to deter the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had the Red Army stationed in Eastern Europe. It then created the Warsaw Pact, its own military alliance, and NATO was the counterweight. And the beauty of NATO for many decades was that it did nothing. It sat there with a credible deterrent, and the Soviet Union did not, in fact, mount an attempt to overrun Europe, and eventually the Soviet Union collapsed. So if you stop history in 1991, the point at which the Soviet Union dissolves, then I have to say, you know, you can debate whether NATO was exactly the right instrument to create. You can have lots of debates, but essentially NATO fulfilled its mission, was extremely successful in doing so, and I don't have any fundamental problem with NATO or US membership in NATO to that point. The issue comes after the collapse of the Soviet Union. At that time, the United States might have decided that in the absence of credible threats to the United States and to core U.S. interests and partners, the United States could have pulled back militarily. That might have meant revamping NATO, might have meant scrapping NATO. My choice would have been to encourage the Europeans to create a new structure for cooperation, which actually the Europeans did. It's called the European Union. It just doesn't handle military affairs. That's what NATO does. So, but the United States suppressed European initiatives to provide for the defense of Europe from 1991 to the present. Instead, the United States wanted itself to be the dominant element in European security. And so not only did the United States remain in NATO, but it advocated, as did other members of NATO, the expansion of NATO, first in 1999, with many rounds thereafter.
Well, before we get into the series of attempts to expand, I mean, was there any concerted push by any NATO members in Europe to say, hey, okay, now we're done with this? Or was there a sense of like, we've got somebody sort of paying our bills on some level, and maybe we're getting a certain amount of economic activity associated with the bases that the Americans have here? Like, what was, you know, I can understand America's or at least, I don't know if understand is the right word, but I'm aware that, you know, the United States, that our establishment felt like, well, we still want a hand in this. But what was the European disposition towards NATO at that point? Did they sort of feel like we don't need this anymore, or was it just we're getting a freebie?
I think it was more the latter. You know, why oppose a U.S. security guarantee? And not only that, you know, what were the harms? What were the risks? This is one of the problems, I think, both for Europe and for the United States in the 1990s. Russia was flat on its back. It did not have an easy transition to a post-Soviet democracy or even a thriving post-Soviet economy. And so even though Russia, now you might consider Russia to be in Europe. So if Russia's European, then Russia certainly preferred a different structure where at a minimum, NATO would not be expanded beyond a reincorporated Germany, but preferably Russia would be part of European security arrangements. And there was actually consideration of something like this in the early years of the Clinton administration called a Partnership for Peace, in which, you know, NATO could incorporate Russia and other Russian-aligned nations into a wider structure. And so actually the U.S. Pentagon was relatively skeptical early on, talking 93, that the United States should commit itself to the defense of enlarged NATO. Looking ahead, because the Pentagon, you know, is actually tasked with providing deterrence and with having to fight a war. So skepticism was quickly eclipsed. It was eclipsed by about 1994 in the Clinton administration. And yet through the 1990s, as I point out in the op-ed that I wrote, there was still a healthy debate about NATO and the U.S. role in NATO in the United States. In the first round of enlargement, The Senate took a vote in 1998, and 10 Democrats voted against the first round of enlargement to three countries, and 9 Republicans joined them. If you flash forward to the present, there are basically unanimous votes in the Senate to admit that the last two NATO members are North Macedonia and Montenegro. These countries were admitted under the Trump administration. No opponent of NATO, Donald Trump. That is a misnomer. Right. So there's been actually a narrowing of a political debate in the United States on the specific question of NATO over time, even as the costs and the risks of the United States remaining the paramount guarantor of security in Europe have become more apparent.
I also remember in the early 90s, the talk of the peace dividend. I mean, this was going to be huge. And it felt like it never materialized. And I wonder how much of that talk of the peace dividend was perceived as a threat to the interests of those institutions and entities that make their money from there not being a sort of a comfortable peace, right? Like, because the peace dividend was like theoretically, like, we're not going to have to spend as much money on tanks and planes and this and that because we don't have the threat that was inherent in the Cold War. And somebody must have said, like, hey, wait a second, we're the ones selling the tanks or the planes. So that peace dividend, that might not work out so well. I mean, how much did that have to do with it? Because by the late 90s, you didn't hear much about the peace dividend anymore.
No, the late 90s was the unipolar moment, and we were off to the races with neoconservatives and liberal interventionists on the ascent. And that's very important for understanding the U.S. reaction to 9/11. But yeah, the peace dividend was something that both George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton promised to deliver in the race for president in 1992. One of the problems was that the United States could still cut defense spending through the 90s as a percentage of GDP. So there was a kind of peace dividend relative to the previous era of the Cold War. And yet it could emerge more powerful relative to others than ever by the end of that decade, not because of us, but because of the fact that China was still quite poor. Russia was struggling to rebound from the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it was a have your cake and eat it too moment and perhaps decade. And I think that also in turn obviously left the military industrial complex intact and created some dangerous assumptions that the United States can kind of act however it likes around the world that are still with us.
Right. And certainly the number of bases we had in 1991 was certainly, well, I should say we didn't have any less. We don't have any less today than we had then. I think we probably have, I don't know, 20 or 30 more, if I remember correctly, maybe even more than that from 91. So we started to see there was a hesitancy, at least, you know, a quarter of the Senate nearly was against the idea of expansion. Remind us what those arguments were. And in many respects, they were fairly prophetic.
That's right. So let's take the liberal Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone, who voted against the first Iraq War in 1991, and then cast a vote against the second Iraq War, that vote held in 2002. Well, in between, he also had to vote on the first round of NATO enlargement that extended the security guarantee of NATO to three countries. And he made the argument that, look, we should accept a good thing. Europe is whole and free. Europe is not divided anymore. And his concern was that reviving and expanding a military alliance in Europe would lead Europe to be redivided by poisoning relations with Russia, because Russia could not really do other than see the expansion of the NATO military alliance as adversarial towards Russia. This is an alliance that has its entire history consisting of pointing weapons at Moscow. But, you know, I think everybody kind of understood that Russia would be antagonized. But even on the other side, who really cared? What was Russia going to do about any of this at that point? And also, nobody knew at that time exactly how far NATO enlargement would go. So I think Wellstone and other critics had a very important insight, but it was one that didn't pack the potency at the time that it would have needed to break through the inertia of the status quo, to override the argument that through NATO admission, that would help to stabilize and democratize the former Warsaw Pact and Soviet states in Eastern Europe, because there are admission standards to NATO. So there were some short-term apparent benefits and long-term costs. And guess what? We went for the short-term benefits.
That is shocking. I understand. So the concept is, you know, to be part of NATO, you need to have a certain amount of democracy for a shorthand. And theoretically, that's going to create more stability down the road. And the argument that, hey, this may antagonize Russia was like, well, yeah, so what? I mean, what are they going to do about it? That doesn't make any difference to us. But what was the purported, like, what was the idea that we're going to get more stability? I mean, what was really the impetus behind it there? I mean, I get the idea that, like, this is going to help democratize other places, but there would have been other ways to do that, it seems to
right.
me. And if you have stability, I don't know how you think you're going to get what you're going to get from more stability. Were there certain, like, markets reforms that were necessary to become part of NATO, that maybe there was moneyed interests that were, you know, sort of driving this? Or
yeah, so you're right that there were other mechanisms to achieve reforms, liberal reforms, market reforms in the new states that NATO ended up incorporating. EU admission also was on the table, and recent research by Paul Post and Alexandra Chinchilla, two political scientists, has found that the EU standards better explain transitions to liberal democracy in Eastern Europe than does NATO membership, which makes sense because NATO is a military alliance. We have to insist that NATO is not some catch-all scheme for general international cooperation. An alliance is an alliance. It is a military alliance. That's serious business, but it's no more than that. It's no less than that, where we today have this discourse where alliances seem to be conflated with friendships, partnerships, collaborative relationships. It's just not so.
All right. And so, okay. So we, NATO starts to expand, and the expansion becomes more and more threatening, to Russia. And so we're on this sort of like track to expand or NATO is to expand and become more of a threat to Russia. And meanwhile, Russia, the implications of that also change, right? I mean, on the Russian end. So take us through that. I mean, when we're in the aughts in particular, and we should also say this is like the ascendance of the neocons, and talk about the implications of that as well.
Yeah, I do grand strategy, and so I like to think about Europe policy in conjunction with the rest of American foreign policy, and it's important to do that. So NATO, the attraction of NATO for American leaders was that, it was going to build on the success of America's post-war leadership of the world. They thought, in 1919, things went haywire because the United States retreated to so-called isolationism. In 1945, we got it right and committed the United States to playing the dominant role politically and militarily around the globe. And so in this new moment of the recasting of the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the same formula was required, even though the circumstances were extremely different. So that provided a real ballast to that view. And that's what starts to also inform the expansion of NATO to more and more members. And so in 2004, the Baltic states were admitted to NATO as well as a handful of other former Soviet bloc states. The Baltic states are two of them on Russia's border. This is happening under the George W. Bush administration, in the aftermath of 9/11 and while the war in Iraq is going on. It's the same people who think that this is a good idea, right? And it's a lot of the same logic that we see applied toward the Middle East and toward Europe, which is the United States will pursue its interests, its power position, and stand up for democracy and human rights by partnering with, half of the region, in fact, allying with it militarily, and leaving the other half in the position of being real or potential enemies. The consequences in the Middle East, we know that story. In Europe, the consequences have been much more benign because Europe is a stable, prosperous region. And it's really at the end of the day, only Russia that sees NATO as a threat. But now we've gotten to the point where after 2008, NATO declared again with U.S., strong U.S. support, that Ukraine and Georgia would be admitted into the accession process to NATO. And that was a real red line for Russia. And that is part of the causal context for Russia undertaking military occupations in parts of Georgia and for after a pro-Russian leader was overthrown in Ukraine, for annexing Crimea, where there's a key naval base that allows Russia access to the Black Sea, and supporting separatists in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. So now we've seen actual conflict result. The other expansions of NATO didn't have that effect, even though Russian leaders and elites, not just Putin or anything, it's Russian elites consistently warned, this is setting us up for trouble. And we don't believe you when you say that the military alliance that is expanding right to our doorstep is somehow not aimed at us. But now we've come to a point where it's very hard to see how NATO could possibly expand further without doing great damage. And the question of membership for Ukraine is still on the table. It was discussed at the NATO summit last week. But I don't think it's going to happen, given that Germany and France quite reasonably oppose extending a NATO membership to Ukraine. The U.S. position is actually a little more moderate, even though it would be the United States. Presumably, that would take the lead if it came to a war with Russia in Ukraine. But I think even having the door open to Ukraine creates negative effects. It creates a false hope among Ukrainian leadership that if they go to war, perhaps they will have the United States military and that of the other NATO allies to back them up. And that can incentivize reckless behavior on their part, leading them to take risks that they otherwise wouldn't take, given that if it comes to a war just between Russia and Ukraine, it's pretty hard to see how Russia wouldn't win.
Okay, so there's a couple of things. I want to just sort of put a flag in to the question of how could we or NATO have messed up so badly as to sort of ostensibly try and avoid a conflict and do the very thing that would promote a conflict. I want to circle back to that. But first, like the idea back in, you know, in 2008, because I remember, John McCain in particular was very, very interested in this expansion of NATO. He was very intimately involved in the neocon project. I mean, people forget that as late as 2000, maybe it was seven, I think he was saying, like, you know, how long can we stay in Iraq? I don't know. How long have we stayed in Germany? I mean, he was basically saying we can have an open-ended occupation. It's not a problem. How much, like, during this era, and by this era, I mean really from early 90s into the, you know, the end of the aughts, as it were, of the 2000s, was there any sort of cohesive counterbalance to the neocon vision that was outlined in the Project of New America Century, which was essentially the U.S. is going to be a hyperpower. And our job is we're going to maintain a Pax Americana around the world. There'll be tiny little conflicts, but those tiny little conflicts around the world will actually serve to maintain our hyperpower status by not allowing any sort of cohesive challenge to our power to emerge. And, you know, ultimately, maybe China, you know, there was an underestimation of what would happen with China's economy. But there was a disregard for just Russia, period. But was there any counterbalance to that? Because it doesn't feel like there was any sort of cohesive ideology or vision for something other than America as a hyperpower.
Yeah, I wish I could say yes. I suspect the answer is no, although maybe I need to write a book on this. You know, I think if there was an intellectually cohesive comeback, it was largely confined to academia. In the 1990s, some academics come up with a grand strategy of restraint, given that the United States doesn't face major threats anymore. Their view is, why make costly commitments commitments that at best will lead the United States to spend more on defense and at worst can actually lead us into conflict in the future? So they sketch that out, but it's pretty much confined to academia. There are some couple think tankers in Washington. The Cato Institute, the Libertarian Cato Institute, was really first into a grand strategy of restraint. At moments, people of this disposition spoke out. There was an open letter opposing the Iraq War with some people from the restraint camp and others who saw it as a terrible idea for other reasons. It's not like those people, having been proved right, gained power and influence in Washington, D.C., quite the contrary. So I think for the two decades you've mentioned, pretty much there was a debate between one flavor of U.S. military primacy and another flavor of U.S. military primacy. And I think we're just breaking out of the confines of that debate.
It certainly feels that way. And that explains why you could go from, in the late 90s, 10 senators voting against the expansion of NATO. And by the time you get to 2010, there's nobody. It's a foregone conclusion. Why wouldn't we? Where are we now in terms of, like, you know, the United we've moderated in terms of, like, we're starting to put the brakes on because we see that what many people predicted was that this is actually going, the expansion of NATO is not going to stabilize anything. It is going to be a destabilizing force. What is the next step that we should take? I mean, you suggest that we should probably allow NATO to be more just European and let the dust settle on some level.
Yeah. And let me say, the effects of NATO were arguably were stabilizing for several decades. It's just that they didn't yet impinge on vital Russian interests until they did. Right. And now where do we go? So I think it would be quite risky for the United States to remain the leading provider of European security. And for the life of me, even if you think NATO has a vital role to play, I do not know why it could be that states like France, Germany, the UK cannot defend themselves and defend Europe. It just beggars belief why they can't do that. They can. But why would they if the United States says, hey, you can keep your defense spending pretty low. We'll take care of it.
Right. And the fact that NATO has sort of outlived its purpose within the context of Europe is manifested in its sort of now looking beyond the horizon. Just talk about that, because it's now, this is where we get into, you know, a solution without a problem. And it's just sort of like looking around, where can I be relevant here? And presumably this is, I mean, what's driving that? Is that the United States driving that? Or is it just, you know, the military industrial complex driving that? Like, we need to make NATO relevant because we're selling too much to let this market dry up.
Yeah, from the 1990s to the present, leading figures have said NATO needs to go out of area or out of business, recognizing that it was unclear exactly what the purpose of this great military alliance was. So what NATO did was go out of area, and that meant assisting the United States in military operations in the greater Middle East. Well, first, there were the interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s. That's not so out of area. But then NATO forces fought alongside Americans for 20 years in Afghanistan. They're now being withdrawn. NATO also was the key institution that undertook the intervention in Libya, which the British and the French were particularly keen on, and the United States under Obama supported. And part of the motive, I mean, fundamentally, the endless wars in the Middle East were the result of U.S. foreign policy failures. It's not like NATO somehow dragged the U.S. into it. That's not the case. But NATO has provided some legitimacy and support. And part of the incentive, I think, for the European members of NATO is, hey, if we can go out of area and show the United States that we support its ambitions around the world, then the United States will be happy about this and remain committed to its leadership role in Europe. And now we've come to a new phase in the out of area ambitions of NATO, because in last week's summit, the most significant news was that NATO contained a lot of language about China in its official communique, casting China as an important challenger to the so-called rules-based international order. And so, you know, you might ask, what does NATO have to do with China? NATO's a military alliance centered in Europe. China is in China. The Chinese military is not distributed around the globe with a network of military alliances and bases. And I'm skeptical that there is a hell of a lot for NATO Europe to do with respect to China. But it seems to be, I mean, I actually do think Europe could play a useful role in trying to calm down the United States and not go overboard in its great power competition with Russia and China. That's useful, but it's not necessary or I think even beneficial for Europe to play that role through a US-led NATO form. Better for Europe to take its destiny into its hands, as Angela Merkel said several years ago after Trump's election, actually create a Europe-led and owned security arrangement in Europe, focus on defending Europe, not making small contributions to U.S. efforts elsewhere. And even if you're a China hawk, that's actually better for that agenda, because it frees up the United States to focus on counterbalancing China in East Asia. Or if you're not a China hawk, it frees up the United States to send troops home and invest more in its own people.
It feels like what NATO does now is it enables the United States to make these decisions. I mean, this is the thing I think that you mentioned the Ukraine's decision making process is influenced by the perception that NATO may back it, and therefore it will be riskier and be more prone to engage in conflict. The same the dynamic's not exactly the same. Well, the dynamic seems similar. The United States feels more comfortable entering into conflict A, Y or X, because NATO is joining it. It provides just a little bit, it's maybe anywhere from greasing the wheels to pushing the cart a little bit there. And so is there any discernible political base or faction to do what you say in that regard? I mean, because it does feel like the idea that NATO needs to exist to protect Europe from China just seems nonsensical. And even the construct of like they are a threat to the rules based structure of the world, I don't know what that really, I'm sure it means something, but it sounds like it's made up a little bit.
Don't be sure that it means something.
That's what I mean. It just sounds like we need to figure out, like, where they're not behaving politely in other social circumstances, and we just need to be around to remind them or something.
I have plenty of problems with Chinese activities, but to say that they're a threat to some rules-based order, I do have a problem with that. It's this rules-based order is actually a pretty recent phrase. It is, I think, impossible to define. And most importantly, in a practical sense, it is a way of saying China's a threat to us without actually specifying right what that threat is, creating this fear that doesn't otherwise need to be there.
Right.
So it is pretty, pretty dangerous, I think.
All right. So, But is there any like will?
Oh yeah. Okay. You asked me a question. I forgot the question. So, you know, I think that, Donald Trump did kind of stir up some critical thinking on the conservative side about alliances. I don't know that it really was a net positive. First of all, I think that's part of the reason why on the left, there is this protection of alliances and moralization of alliances, because it seems like Donald Trump was opposed to them. I think there's just a misunderstanding there, because Trump did not, in fact, oppose any alliances as president. He allowed the alliances to grow. And I think what a lot of people on the left really mean is that they want to be part of the world. They want to cooperate. They want to tackle common challenges. And there's a confusion as to whether alliances are really part of cooperation. So I am hoping that people will think more critically about NATO, wherever they fall on the issue at the end of the day, that if we see it for what it is, a military alliance that, like any other military alliance, can, yes, it might deter bad behavior, but it also risks war, I think we'll be in a much healthier place. So there are some stirrings of at least criticism on the Republican side. I think if progressives and Democrats think about what they already believe, a lot of them already believe about American foreign policy, that we should end endless war and prevent new ones, that we should play a smaller military role in the 21st century world, that we should reduce our defense spending and make better investments here at home and focus on the real international challenges that affect Americans where they live and work, like climate change, like pandemic disease. If you have those commitments, I merely ask, connect the dots to the U.S.-dominated military alliance of NATO.
And what about within the Europeans in NATO? Are they becoming more skeptical in any respect, or is that just sort of like inviting a huge cost that they don't necessarily want to pick up?
Both at once. There are increasing discussions in European capitals of what they call strategic autonomy. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, has been at the forefront of these discussions. He even called several years ago for the formation of a European army that would be under the auspices of the European Union and therefore independent of the United States. You know, how much support there really is for this in Europe remains to be seen. I think that the Biden administration, with its reassurances that America's back, that that it regards the collective security provision of NATO as a sacred obligation, as the president has repeated many times, that may paper over these European stirrings for more autonomy. But over the longer term, I think they will continue, and they might even continue in parallel with the Biden administration's reassurances about the U.S. commitment to NATO, since there's a lot of uncertainty about who the next president will be and what the future of the American political system is. And because Europeans really don't want to be conscripted into a U.S. effort to, you know, make the world choose between engaging economically with China and engaging economically with the United States. Same with the choice between Russia and the United States. So I think that a lot of Europeans are appreciating that there are some divergences between where Europe wants to go and where America wants to go. So I'm, you know, interested. I don't know about optimistic, but I'm interested in how the thinking across the Atlantic shapes up in the short term and especially in the longer term.
All right, one last question, and this is a little bit devil's advocate here. Is there any? I mean, let's assume we have a world where NATO does not expand. where the, at least its posture looks a little bit more inward and just says, we're just going to be defensive. We don't necessarily need to bring, you know, other countries. We don't need to stabilize other countries in this manner. We can do it through maybe admission to the EU or some other, or, you know, alliance. Does the idea that there is no standing European army in some respects ratchet down a threat? In other words, like, you know, would having a standing European army that's just sitting around with nothing to do represent maybe to Russia, let's say, maybe perhaps more of a potential threat than the idea that, well, the United States is across the Atlantic. There's, you know, they don't have any necessarily, like, you know, the idea that the U.S. is going to fight on behalf of Ukraine is a hard sell in the United States, might not be as hard of a sell in, you know, some European countries. Is there any merit to that idea?
That's a very serious point. You know, it's not like, look, security is difficult. There are always going to be risks in any context. So there could be risks that, you know, if the Europeans seem particularly aggressive toward Russia, that, you know, things could go worse for Europe than what we have now. But that's unlikely to be the case, I think. You know, it's the major powers of Europe, Germany and France, that are clearly opposed to, for example, extending NATO membership to Ukraine, whereas the United States has been more assertive in that regard. So I actually worry that it's the faraway United States that seems more concerned about threats to Europe that affect Europe more than they affect us, right? Threats from Russia. So I think in the long run, it'd be better for Europe's security. But one never knows exactly. And, you know, yes, Emmanuel Macron may be interested in European strategic autonomy. He was also perhaps interested in doing more militarily in Africa to fight terrorism. Those are not, you know, necessarily good things. But that is part of allowing others to step up in the world and make some decisions for themselves. A huge beneficiary of the U.S. stepping back from Europe will be the United States. Europe is capable of defending Europe. They may make mistakes, but if they make mistakes and the United States has to get more involved militarily, we will have at least given things a shot, and we can feel confident that our security is extremely significant given where the United States is located. We don't have to put ourselves on the front lines of every existing conflict and of any future conflict. I don't think that the American people really want to spend the rest of the 20th century in armed conflicts or standoffs that risk World War III with Russia or China or others.
Stephen Wertheim, the book is Tomorrow of the World, The Birth of a U.S. Global Supremacy, and Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And that's stuff to think about in terms of NATO. Alliances can sometimes lose their point, and I think then they start working against their point in the first place. So there's that. Now, Emma, we have Fun Half could be super fun today.
It could be, yeah.
And we're going to have to take a break, and we're actually probably going to end the stream. But we're going to say goodbye to our Peacock viewers, and we will be back tomorrow. You can watch this show on Peacock, 10 p.m. every day.
and watch our other Peacock show every day at 5 p.m. And it's also on demand. So for you Peacock viewers, we will see you tomorrow. For you non-Peacock viewers who have the ability to watch the Fun Half, I think we might have something interesting to talk about at the Fun Half today. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to be, but we might have something very, very fun to tease, to talk about, whatever
it is. Fingers crossed.
We'll see. But we can't know right now, but we will know, oddly, in the Fun Half. And we will explain in the Fun Half how it is that we can't even tell you whether we're going to have something interesting to talk about in whatever 30 seconds when the Fun Half happens shortly after this. So
this is like incredibly mysterious, but
it's very mysterious. It has to do with the time space continuum. And well, when we come back, it's going to be much later than it is now.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun Half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Ever see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black. Black Africans are back, back.
Come on. West, come on. West, come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.